Hello and welcome to the Veeam Community Podcast. I am your host, Rick Vanover. This is episode 23, Hot, Why Not? Here we go. Today my guest is Sean Clark. How are you doing, Sean?
Real good. It's been a long day of work, Little League Baseball, and working out, and then now I get to speak with you, Rick.
We call that a nightcap around here, baby. Hopefully your Little League Baseball event didn't result in something going on America's Funniest Home Videos, you know, with you getting hit in the head or in another region by a ball or anything.
Nope, and I made it the whole game. The umpires did not have to remove me, so we did good.
Cool, no police were involved. Awesome.
Yeah.
All right, well, hey, Sean. I've known you, you know, for a while, and some of the inner circle of the blogosphere is quite familiar with you. But can you take a moment and introduce yourself and a certain event that you are most nefarious for?
Well, yeah, I can introduce myself, and I'll try to keep it short here. But, yeah, I'm Sean Clark, and I've been doing the VMware thing for over 5 years now, and I have a VCP number of, I think, 5300, so that puts me back there a ways, but not with some of the folks. Been doing VMware for 5 years and a number of capacities in healthcare at a small VAR in Iowa, and now as a contractor for tech systems at a large enterprise. And what I'm most, I guess, known for recently is with my partner in crime, Theron Conroy. Sorry, Theron. Is the VM Underground party. So this is actually Theron's brainchild from, I think 5 years ago. It was very small, and then it was three VM Worlds ago. We decided, hey, let's try to get some micro sponsors. And I think Doug Hazelman was one of the first to say, yeah, that'd be great. Veeam would love to help with that, you know. And we got people for a little bit of money, and we got maybe 10 different sponsors to help out. It was a zoo, but it was a great night at the Thirsty Bear. Went back last year, and it was a zoo again, and reduced the sponsors. And but we're packed, and we've had to turn a lot of people away, and it's been kind of a bummer. So this year in Vegas, we're going big.
And
I'm not really sure what's been publicized about this, but we are looking at a site that is 500. People.
Look out!
Yeah, so this is about 2.5 times what the Thirsty Bear can hold. There'll be a stage.
Oh, wow.
There will be, if you stay long enough, there'll be music. I don't think we're getting the band, but I think after the party's done, I think we're just going to stay and enjoy the show.
Mm-hmm.
But, I might as well announce it. It is New York, New York. We have it on hold. If you've ever been to Vegas, it's a nice place. Not the whole New York, New York. That'd be ridiculous. But
I'd go.
No.
Well,
I think it's called Nine Fine Irishmen, right?
5-9, or the Irish place.
The Irish place in New York, New York.
Nine Fine Irishmen?
I think that's it.
Yeah.
So it'll be a blast. And we're glad to have Veeam sponsoring again.
Oh, sweet.
Along with a few others, so it'll be a good time. And we'll be opening up, the ticket system through Eventbrite probably in another month or so that people can make their plans. But shouldn't be a problem getting a ticket this year like it has been in the past, so we're happy about that.
Well, cool. I didn't mean to prod out the details of that, but, yeah, if it's getting about that time, we might as well start setting the tone. I like it. I like it. Yeah, so Sean is really, you know, that's what he's most known for, I guess. But, you know, he's also a real smart guy. And what we wanted to talk about today was disaster recovery strategies. And Sean and I have been talking about, you know, data protection and site management strategies over the last couple of months. Just a quick plug from Veeam is that Sean's provided us a couple of webinars and white papers, I think, on a couple of different topics, so definitely check those out. But one of the things that Sean and I were talking about before one of the events was, you know, a lot of people kind of go this primary site, secondary site, kind of hard line layout. But I'm like, well, if you're putting in production equipment in both sites, why not go production on both ends to a certain extent? You know, you might have 70% production and, you know, 30% of that, of your production, 70% might be on one site or 30% in the other or something like that. But I'm just kind of throwing that out as a design consideration. And I'm curious, Sean, what you've ever done to try to, like, you know, kind of break that hot and cold model and just kind of go prod on both ends. What kind of strategies have you used over the years?
Well, it does definitely come down to what the customer's trying to do and the requirements. But budget more than anything, I think, is one of the big things. Yeah. And actually, you know, budget just to justify having a second site is the hardest part for the masses, right? For the small, medium business. You know, because, you know, why are we going to, in a down economy, why are we going to spend, you know, thousands, almost hundreds of thousands of dollars in some cases to stand up this DR site for something that should never happen, mm-hmm. right? Or, you know, if you look at the odds, the disaster isn't likely to happen, right? So it's hard to get buy-in, especially when there's other things that are important to the business. But I guess it's pretty close to home here with Joplin, Missouri, and what just happened. And boy, it sure does happen, and it's nice to have a plan for that. But I guess to get to your question, you know, I like to go for 50-50 if I could.
Sure.
And a lot of that, I think, comes down to what is your business like and where are you distributed to? What are your apps like? So 50-50 is great, but if that means I'm putting latency sensitive applications on the other end of my WAN pipe, you know, at a remote site when all my users are back at headquarters, well, that probably isn't going to fly if you're affecting user experience to those applications.
Yeah, in my experience, what I had in two of the three environments, you know, where I'm using virtualization for production slash, I don't want to say DR, squeeze it in, but, you know, when we were trying to architect around what we had multiple locations for the organization and pretty good connectivity between them, okay? And that the fundamental reason for that was that there were significant, you know, pockets of the company workforce in both locations. And because of that, we were able to, I guess in my personal experience, I kind of went that 70-30/60-40 arrangement. But then again, you know, you put what's important on both ends of that. You know, you keep your latency in mind, of course. But it's one of those things that if you have workers spread in both, so it's a 30-40 or, you know, a 70% chance that they're going to be in this data center or in that location or whatever, then you might want to just, you almost have to kind of put your workloads where the people are, but also
sure.
account for, you know, some issues as far as interruptions and stuff like that. And, you know, I guess the best example is, of course, you know, make your Active Directory domain services available on both sites. You know, don't kind of go to fail it over. Just have it running production on the other end. And, you know, that type of infrastructure, you know, for DNS and basic networking, if you're using Active Directory for that, isn't really a heavy hitter. But then when you're talking about databases and applications being live, that's when it starts to get a little bit more complicated. What kind of you know, strategies have you ever used? I've got a strategy I can share, but, you know, specifically with databases, you know, we can replicate databases, you know, Veeam can replicate them, SQL can replicate them, stuff like that. I got a trick I'll share if you haven't done it, but what kind of stuff have you done around databases to kind of move them to, you know, other locations?
So, I guess we've done it all. So
yeah.
I guess Exchange, if you count that as a database. Most recently, we've not with the current client, but back at the old gig, we had some clients that were setting up Exchange in a multi-site environment. They chose to use Exchange replication, or I guess it was a continuous clustered replication.
Mm-hmm.
So didn't really matter, you know, how you're protecting the environment, and didn't necessarily need SAN replication or Veeam replication for that.
Right.
But they did use Veeam type replication for other aspects of their infrastructure. I guess on the database side, we haven't done anything too crazy out of the box. It's just, you know, the straight up Veeam backups or SRM using SAN replication,
mm-hmm.
And just replicating those single standalone databases. So, and that's where you'll see it most of the time, is in the single onesie twosies.
Yep.
If it's a big boy and it's mission critical, you know, I sometimes feel better using what's built into the app, so that we do kind of have a hot yep. application. So,
well, I'm with you, because I had a situation in my, you know, the early part of my virtualization prowess where SRM wasn't an option, specifically mm-hmm. by SRA support for the storage processor in use. So we were really kind of cornered into off-the-shelf, you know, virtualization tools or application-level stuff matched with infrastructure team magic. And in my case, we went the latter. So, you know, SQL Server replication. And then here's a cool little trick. And I keep talking it up, and every now and then somebody would be like, yeah, it's a great idea. But here's what we did. We did SQL Server replication, and then for applications that required that class of database availability, we would have the applications connect not directly to the SQL Server, but to a DNS CNAME alias.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so if you had to flip it over to the other database, you change the DNS record, allow propagation to happen without having to touch the server, or more specifically, sometimes you had to have client applications that had their own ODBC connection strings. You definitely wouldn't want to have to change all of those. I mean, in that situation, you'd actually make the remote end assume the name, honestly, is what you'd have to do. But, you know, really, you could have a Site A database and a Site B database server, and they hold the same database, but then with SQL Server replication, if you had to flip it over, you could do it through a DNS record. And, yeah, that was a little trick we had learned over the years, and you could also do it with an alias, an A record, just point to an IP. But, you know, the CNS or the CNAME to a fully qualified DNS name was a little trick that I kind of felt most comfortable doing, again, absent of, a SRM solution or at the time we didn't have a virtualization option that would have done replication as such. And in that case, it was a big one, too. You know, it was probably in the single database application was in like, you know, 500, 700 gig or something like that. So, you know, it's a little bit much to kind of throw on a onesie twosie replication schedule. But you bring up a good point about SRM, and I already did my one shameless plug for Veeam, so I'll do another one. But this one's kind of cool. It's one of those ecosystem shameless plugs. A lot of people have asked, you know, should I use Veeam, SRM, or both, or neither, or what do I do? And I wrote a white paper that kind of caught your interest, Sean, and I wish I would have had you help me write it. But basically, I threw out a white paper for Veeam about how the tools are complementary. And, you know, in our stance, you know, you should use both, really, because SRM is your big red button, and, you know, Veeam is your data protection on the primary site. And if you wanted to do an individual replication without automated failover, that would be a good solution. So, you know, check that out if you're interested or thinking about that.
Well, and what a lot of people don't know, and I'm not sure how widely developed it is, but within Veeam, you can access the recovery from some PowerShell commandlets. Now, I haven't done this, but I've read a little bit on that. That's something available. Is that right, Rick? Or,
you know, I gotta plead ignorance. I've never used the
punt.
Yeah, punt. Edit that out. No, I've seen the PowerShell extension for VBNR, but I've never used it. I'll be honest with you, I'm not really the PowerShell type of dude. But, you know, everybody asks me a lot of times, they're like, well, how do I do this and that? And I'm like, well, you know, we've got a PowerShell extension. And then they just go away because they figure it out. So people are using it, okay? So,
right. Well, it'd be more handy on the replication side, I think. So, like, if you had a replica. And I guess this is always an option with Veeam, right, that you can just you could power on the replica through standard VCR tools, but you kind of lose some, do you lose some recovery ability, or does that mess up the catalog or something?
No, I mean, it's still there. I think that you'd want to consult the user's guide on how to do the failover, because the wizard might be the best way to do it. But mainly, once you do that, you know, you still have to re-IP. There's a roadmap item to get automatic re-IPing put into the replication capability. I keep asking Ghost Dev when that's going to happen, and he just tells me it's on the list. So,
I'll quit torturing you, but I guess where it's going is that, you know, SRM has some recovery, custom recovery plans that you can do, and you can insert anything you can run from a command line. So if it's PowerShell, if it's, you know, Perl or your batch files, whatever it is, you could have the two live in harmony, so to speak, and use SAN replication for maybe some heavier, you know, for whatever you're using it for, right? But then rely on a Veeam for the granular. So
true. Well, and that, and I don't really see SRM as I need to recover a file or.
No.
You know, that's not the tool for that. So, I mean, they're definitely complementary, you know, and then in the white paper, I kind of ran it through the, you know, the meat factory of, you know, why these are different, why they're similar, those types of things. So I have to, I don't have it in front of me, but yeah, check it out if you're in that situation.
Sure.
So yeah, you know, it's like one of those things. Hot is a good way to leverage the investment in both ends. You know, that's another way to think about it. You know, the budget to get money for a quote-unquote DR site, whether it be within your own environment, and the SMB might be tough. They might only have one location. But if you're putting gear in another site, even if it's like a colo, might as well put it to use. You know, it's a tough sell to say, look, CFO, I'm going to spend all this money. We may never have a problem. I may never use it. Okay? And it's just going to be sitting there with green lights for 3-5 years or something like that. So,
well, that's the beauty, though, of the virtualization, though, right, is that it's no longer just sitting there for your yearly DR test or your quarterly, right? You know, it's virtual. It's controlled by an API. There's nothing that prevents you from testing this on a daily basis, right? And you should. If you're going to be virtual, you know, I like to go virtual for the availability benefits, not necessarily the management and the consolidation. I mean, that's an older story, and I think people are beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
Today, it's in a lot of regards, it's about flexibility and what you do with it. And you know, in the DR space, there's so many creative things that you can do with it. And you know, I think that's fun seeing what you guys are doing with Sure Backup and seeing what VMware is doing with SRM and giving users and customers the ability to automate that test daily if they want to, right? So that when it does come time to declare disaster, it's not your first dance.
Well, that brings up a good question. How often, you know, do you test the DR? I mean, I've been in a couple of different arrangements, once with an outsource provider that I didn't really have much of an involvement with, and then the other was, you know, we all got into it yearly and that kind of stuff. What's your experience? Has it been quarterly? Is that frequent?
Quarterly for, you know, portions of the environment,
mm-hmm.
but not the whole thing. In the smaller business side and healthcare especially, it was HIPAA said, you know, do it yearly.
Right.
So you did it yearly.
Yep.
And it wasn't much more than that, and mostly because you still had ISVs requiring physical or whatnot, and you had a significant physical server, you know, deployment, so it was a pain in the butt. So once a year was, that's enough money down the drain.
Yeah, sure.
Operationally, but when we got to virtual, you know, it's doing those things monthly wasn't nearly the time investment that, you know, that you'd think.
Well, the tool makes it easy for you. I mean, there's
yeah,
just no way around
exactly.
that. There's you don't have to shut down. Do you get the primary site even quiet, or do you just charge on like a wild horse?
Wild Horse, because what we have is isolated networks, and you know we take some care to set up directory services inside that that isolated network, so we could do some things. I guess the biggest drain that I had was still having those off VMware dependencies that you just couldn't get away from, and it'd be nice to let DR drive that story for people. But they use their leverage or their cloud or the threat of support or licensing to keep you physical. So
yeah, and I'm with you because as much as I'm, you and I both definitely evangelize and believe in virtualization technologies. It's unfortunate we don't buy these software solutions or we've inherited them. And you're right, they don't support virtualization or, they might be too expensive to virtualize, licensing for one on some things. So you name the reason, they're out there, and we have to deal with them. They are the bricks in our data centers. And unfortunately, they're the type of stuff that yet still needs to be in scope of DR. So those are the one-off challenges that make it really, lack of a better word, suck.
Right. Yeah. So, but you keep plugging, you keep preaching the good word, and eventually,
Well, and the other thing is that all these software companies are on a life cycle, where they're definitely getting the pressure to virtualize, by their customers. And, some things are just too big, and that's fine. Some platforms are just off limits. That's fine. But, you just keep trimming off these loose-hanging ones, and we're on a path looking straight ahead on a road that narrows of what's not virtual and what is. So we'll get there, and the tools are out there, the solutions are out there, the storage companies are making it easy for us. So you name it, we're on the right path. So that's all kind of cool. What's the coolest thing you've done DR wise that isn't necessarily conventional, like within something that SRM's doing, or built-in functionality of a product? It doesn't even have to be like an architecture thing. It could be just I used a closet in the CEO's home office, or what kind of cool thing can you tell me you've ever done? that's something you can tell me. Let me throw it out that way.
The coolest?
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess maybe my first time working with VMware and putting out some proof of concepts for DR with VMs.
Mm-hmm.
I'll probably do that. Maybe it's not the coolest technical thing overall, but back in 2006, and we're virtualizing what the ISV is telling us. Oh, you can't virtualize it, and we did it, and then did a little dog and pony with management about, simulating a server failure, telling them that we'd copied some VMs, and, asking them, how long do you think we're going to be down? And, everyone said, well, days or, whatever, to get the tape and all that. And like, well, look what we were able to do. And we were able to boot the VM, restore the service. And they're pretty excited about that. And I guess just that first time, I think it, I kind of wish I could get that back with some new technology some days, is just those first days with VMware and understanding it and when it was new and exciting. So
was that right when VI3 was released?
Yeah. Actually, this we were doing this with 2.5.
Oh, 2.5, okay.
And it was that summer that 3.0 came out. And
yeah. You know what's weird is I found that the companies that had like a well-refined shared storage network, a SAN in place, mm-hmm. they were like ready to go with this virtualization stuff. I say it like it's foreign to me, but you get what I'm saying. It's like a lot of people that were only direct attached storage, they had a huge obstacle to get to shared storage to then enable the benefits of virtualization. But where were you in 2006 with shared storage? Was it normal?
We had it. Oh, we had it. It was part of the core health information system that we had.
Mm-hmm.
It was Meditech, and they required a SAN, and so all we had to do is add Atreya drives and buy some servers, which I remember specking these bad boys out, some Dell 2850s, dual core, so we had four total cores.
Look out.
16 gig of RAM, and this bad boy was like $12,000, $11,000. It was ridiculous. The memory was through the roof. And then I guess just recently, I just quoted one for my kid's school. I'm on their tech committee, and dual hex core, 24 gig of RAM. No HBA, it's just the onboard NIC. So mm-hmm. I guess I saved maybe 500 there. But the whole thing's like $6,000. I'm like,
well, I'm seeing those servers nuts. On the aftermarket for $600 right
yeah.
now. Yeah. You know what's funny is what I had observed. It was really difficult to go north of 4 gig of RAM back then. And when I say difficult, expensive.
Yeah.
So much so that when we were specking out our environment, one of the first medium sized deployments we were doing. We had just said, it's actually less expensive, VMware licensing and all, to add more hosts.
Okay? Oh, yeah, like the two-socket versus four-socket.
Exactly.
Economy? Totally.
At the time, RAM, and it was RAM that was killing us. It was was ridiculous. So, well, cool. Well, hey, man, I this has been really cool. I want to transition to another part of my podcast, the gimmick section, which is called Three Views from You. And I kind of already asked you one of them, but I'll ask you again, and if you tell the same story, I won't tell anybody. That's fine. So, Sean, in your past, in your work experience, it doesn't have to be, specific to virtualization. Okay, it can be anything related to technology. What's the, the best story or fishtail or anything you can share with us at some point from your past?
I think it would have to be maybe 3 weeks ago. I was looking for ways to save money with my new hobby, which is, if you follow me on Twitter, is homebrewing.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that you could get away with not having to spend $6.50 for yeast for every batch by reusing some of the yeast from a previous batch. So just learning more about the chemistry of yeast, and I think there's a word for this, but I'm not quite in there yet as far as the yeast husbandry. I'm not sure what it's called, but...
Is it like yeast cycling or something?
No, it's like one of the I don't know. Ben Milligan, is he? He's a Veeam guy, right?
Yeah, he's on the support staff.
Yeah, if you check on his Twitter bio, I think the word is there. It starts with a Z.
Oh, I've wondered what the flip of that word was.
Yeah.
I'm gonna look it up here. Hold on, because I need to know.
I think world needs to know.
Yeah, this is important stuff. And there's a lot of method to that madness, right? There's a lot of technology, I guess, you use to do that. Do you use anything automated, or is it just, like, old school?
Zymergist. That's what it is.
I was looking at it, but I didn't know how to pronounce it, so thank you.
I don't know if that's the right pronunciation, but...
Zymergist.
No.
Yeah, look out.
Homebrew has been awesome, and I'm surprised at all the virtualization people out there that do it. So it's been fun.
Oh, cool. Awesome. How about right now? What's going on most with you, technology-wise or hobby-wise, most interesting or that you have the most passion for right now? What can you, say?
Sure.
Yeah.
So... I guess working with tech systems as a contractor for the first time for a major enterprise is it's been awesome for me. Not sure why I avoided working with large companies in the past, but it's something that rocks. I'm just, in case you don't know, I grew up in a small town in western Iowa, about 22 kids, and two of them were foreign exchange students. So maybe you can understand my aversion to working for a big corporate world, but I tell you what, it's been fun, and the problems are big, and the tech is cool to be able to take a hack at those problems.
So there are only 22 kids just living in that town?
No, just in my class.
Oh, okay. I thought it was your family.
No.
Sure. Okay.
No. Although I did live in a town called Botna, Iowa, which you can still find on the map on Google. Oh, there's nothing there. I think they sold the town. But we were living there, and there's like 20 people in this town. Or no, not even that. There was like a dozen. And there was a trailer park on the one side, and this family moved into for a year, basically. And they had seven kids or six kids. So they basically doubled Botna's population just by moving into town. It was awesome.
Wow. I mean, I've not lived in a small place like that. I've lived out in itty-bitty cities, but nothing like that. Interesting.
You're missing out. You have to come out. We can go cow tipping and stuff like that.
Well, I've done that. I mean, I grew up in a rural area, but I don't know. I complain. Columbus, to me, is too big of a city. Grand Rapids, Michigan, where I used to live, was just right, but kind of a little bit short of all the big city stuff that I needed. So I guess maybe the problem's me. I don't know.
Forgot the Columbus angle. So maybe it's, should we take a moment of silence for the divesting of Jim Trestle?
No comment. That's worse than talking religion and politics in this town. We're going to move on. So Sean, looking into the future, what are you most excited about, technology-wise or otherwise?
Sure. I think it wasn't – I was kind of getting into doldrums a year ago, thinking about virtualization and thinking, you know, maybe this is getting easy. Maybe people are understanding it and, you know, it's – I'm not going to really have much to do anymore. But I'm just impressed. Every time VMware releases a roadmap, every time partners come out with new technology – it's just evident to me that it's just starting to hit its stride and that there's still a long way to go. You talk about all the workloads that, you know, can't go virtual because of performance or whatever. And, you know, I'd hate to say that we've hit a bottleneck for performance, because, you know, you don't want to be that famous Bill Gates saying or whatever about what amount of memory was enough for everybody? I don't know if you know that right offhand, Rick.
It was in the K.
Yeah, it was teeny tiny, and you know, we see the core count keep jumping up on these processors. It seems like clock speed has kind of hit a plateau, but you know, there's quantum computing that's kind of out there. It's theoretical. I'm not sure how far it's coming, but you know, you think 5 years in the future, 10 years in the future, there's got to be something that's really going to rock the world and give stuff like virtualization new life or come up with brand new technology I have no clue about that I'm going to fall in love with and want to be right there with it as it grows. Because that's the funny thing about virtualization. In 2005, you know, that's just short 5.5 years ago. You know, I went to my first VMUG, and I didn't know anything about VMware, nothing. And here I am, it's like, it's my career, basically, so.
Well, yeah, it's virtualization. I hate to say it, might be old hat in 10 years, you know. We might have moved on to something greater, and it might just, true. I don't want to say be an afterthought. I mean, we're still going to use it, but, yeah, it's pretty scary how fast technology's moving and how big things are going, and 640K was the number. From 1997. Wow, that's kind of scary because, you know, in 1997, the network server I was administering was less powerful for a, I don't know, $500 million corporation than the phone that I have sitting around my neck, you know, storage included. Interesting. Hey, well, Sean, this has been really good talking to you, thinking out loud in the term of DR site planning. And I want to throw out a couple of notes for everyone. Sean is on Twitter at VSeanClark, and his blog is seanclark.us. You can spot him on Twitter, Tech Field Days, and all that kind of good stuff. This is actually going live after the next Tech Field Day, but you are going, is that correct?
Actually, it's I could go. I think if I wanted to. It's just I have some family obligations that keep me in a family rebellion. But I am looking to host a kind of a Windows 7-ish sort of Tech Field Day viewing party on the Thursday edition. So I'm hoping to invite a few local virtualization type nerds over to the man cave, and we'll have homebrew and stream the Tech Field Day proceedings live.
You know, they're entertaining to watch. I do enjoy watching the streams. I just can't get any work done because it's so, you know, it keeps me on the edge of my seat. I enjoy watching it.
No, it's
awesome.
Good.
Awesome. Well, hey, Sean, thanks again. If anyone has any questions on the podcast, you can send an email to podcast@veeam.com. I'm your host, Rick Vanover, on Twitter, @RickVanover. Sean, thanks again.
Thanks, Rick.
Cheers.